Welcome to a special edition of Flat Chat. I'm Stuart Codling, and I'll be back with Mark Gallagher and Ben Anderson on January the 30th. We'll have a new edition of F1 Racing to look at, amongst other news. In the meantime, here's some of what the people upstairs like to call bonus content. A couple of months ago, we celebrated the 10th anniversary of Jenson Button's World Championship by revealing some of the previously little-known details of that year. The Braun GP CEO Nick Fry was kind enough to share his memories, from the shock of Honda deciding to close the team to its rebirth as Braun GP and the acquisition by Mercedes. Feedback from our readers about the story was really positive, but as usual with such things, there was a lot of interesting stuff that just wouldn't fit on the page. So here, just for you, is the full recording of Nick Fry's visit to the F1 Racing office.
It is a lot to get over in quite a short amount of time, a limited amount of book real estate. But the kind of the first thing that jumped out at me while making my way through the book at the beginning was that Honda basically wanted an immediate shutdown. So you, in what, end of November, beginning of December 2008, you were summoned to this meeting in a slightly downmarket hotel in a small meeting room and were told, OK, right, we're off, bye.
Yeah, I mean, we were summoned, Ross and myself, to see our Japanese boss, who we had a good relationship with. And, you know, we expected not a good meeting. We expected a big cutback, and we'd done enough homework to cut back the budget by about a third. So, you know, we were prepared for what we thought was a bad situation. And this poor gentleman, Mr. Oshima, really, pretty much in tears, told us that, you know, kind of that was it. They were off. You know, the situation on the business side at the start of the financial crisis was that bad that they couldn't actually spend money on Formula One. And, you know, please go to Brackley and tell them all to go home, turn off the lights, was really, you know, the literal message.
Were you kind of thinking on your feet at that point and having to point out to them that there are UK employment laws? You can't just sort of say, that's it, bye.
Yeah, I mean, we went from a meeting of the three of us to a much larger conference room, and that was filled with a larger array of people but clearly the idea was that we should close down. And, you know, I think I was the one that said, well, you can't do that and you've got to give us a chance. And, you know, to be fair to Honda, it's a very big, honourable company. And, you know, after some discussion, we were given a month, which, you know, running up to Christmas of 2008 with the world's worst financial crisis in most people's minds, didn't give us a lot of time. And we met some dodgy characters.
A sort of a fire sale like that does bring some quite eccentric people out of the woodwork, I suppose. If I mentioned Vijay Mallya first, he's among the less eccentric people that you actually encountered and showed an interest. And I was flabbergasted when I read in your book that firstly he'd shown an interest literally within months of having bought Force India, as he was then renaming it, but also that Ross very quickly decided he was a time waster, but not before you'd had to sit waiting for, what was it, 5 hours for him to turn up to a dinner meeting?
Yeah, it was a long wait, but we did get a very good curry at the end of it. So there was a late night reward. So it wasn't all bad. But no, Vijay was one of the people who did express an interest. And he, frankly, was one of the most more honourable people that expressed an interest, which says a lot. And, you know, it really was a situation where you had to kiss a lot of frogs. And, you know, we really couldn't leave any stone unturned, which meant there was a lot of complete time wasters and a lot of time spent over Christmas of that year, at least on my part. And Nigel Kerr was the finance director, meeting people who clearly, you know, were just having a look and having a go, or money laundering, or even worse. So but in those situations, it might have been the right one. So I mean, really, we're nowhere close to resolving the situation of the future until really well into 2009, when, you know, we'd started to do well by that stage, and the quality of potential purchasers and people who would help us in the future went up immensely.
Do you kind of look at Formula One from a distance now and at some of the characters who are associated with either buying teams or bringing a lot of sponsorship to teams and kind of mop your brow and think there, but for the grace of God went I.
On the one hand, you can think that way. On the other hand, part of the reason I wanted to write the book was I really have had the huge pleasure in my career, and I think there's probably another book to be written about this. Worked with some of the real icons of the car industry. I mean, one of the first people I worked with, was the head of motorsport for Ford. For a long period of time. Obviously, I worked with Tom Walkinshaw for a long time at Aston Martin, Walter Hayes, who was the father of the DFV, Jackie Stewart, and I've had a huge... it's been humbling to work with such great people. And I think the time that I was in Formula One, there were some great characters, and you can think what you might of them, but they were there for a reason. And I think that... when people are negative about, they'll say negative things about someone like Flavio Briatore. And my first question to these people of, have you ever even met the person? And invariably the answer is no. And these people, do have interesting or maybe flawed characters, but they're there for a reason. They got to those heights because they have a skill. In Flavio's case, maybe a fantastic marketing skill. And, whilst on the one hand you can say they're scoundrels, on the other hand, I wanted to record a little bit of what it was like to work with some of these people, because it was in the main a great pleasure, and they were there for a reason. They got to the heights because they were just fantastic entrepreneurs, and fantastic entrepreneurs sometimes aren't the best people in a corporate environment. And I guess the reason I survived as long as I did survive in Formula One was because I do come from a corporate background, and I'm probably quite good at dealing with big companies and big sponsors.
The restructuring you underwent with what became the Braun GP team kind of was the making of it, wasn't it? You'd gone from a very tightly structured organisation that kind of you probably... in hindsight, had a lot of interference from above, didn't you, I suppose, as part of the Honda machinery. As an independent entity, you had to sort of slim down. And one of the things that really comes through in the book is that you had to make some very tough decisions early on in terms of who to keep, who to let go. You mentioned a lot of names on the keep list, the likes of James Vowles, Ron Meadows, Andrew Shevlin, who were prominent people that you felt needed to stay. And those people are very much linchpins of the multi-title winning Mercedes Grand Prix operation now.
Yeah, I think the thing I'm most proud of, and I think Ross would probably say the same, is, you have to look at what you left behind. And, what we left behind was a great team, and it's continued to be a great team. We hired some fantastic people. And, to be fair to even going back to Adrian Reynard and Craig Pollock before I arrived at the team, people like Andrew Shevlin and Ron Meadows, were there before I was there. So these are people who, have got huge experience, and that's why they're so difficult to beat. I mean, they have got great resources. They have got, great backing from Mercedes-Benz, but those people have worked together for, 20 years, probably in some cases. And it's a very tightly knit team. They can work together almost without speaking, because they know exactly how each of them, reacts. So it's, it will be a tough job to beat them, anytime soon.
If we kind of drill down a little further into those first few months of 2009, was there a sense of kind of increasing dread or desperation as you tried to find potential owners or investors? You talk about the mysterious Achilles Kaliakis, who I'm keen to know more about, because he seems like a fascinating character. There's a picture of him in the panels in the book, and exactly how you rumbled him in the end, because people like that come along and seem very impressive, and you investigate them. Do you spend 10 grand with a corporate detective
agency? We spent 10 grand with an agency called Kroll, who is one of the really the most famous detective agencies. And, we got them to look at some of the prospective purchasers. And the guy you're talking about, we eventually, and it took a lot of uncovering, found that he had been selling false British hereditary titles to Americans who didn't know better. And I think he got caught out in the end, and he sold one to an American senator who found out the truth of what he bought. But we had some incredible ups and downs, and almost on a daily basis. And I think there's, you know, we had days when we thought we've cracked it, we've got a future, we, you know, have got some money from Honda, we've got some sponsorship, and other days where you just thought, you know, this is kind of it. But all you can do is plow on. And I think there's, you know, Ross and myself and the other directors worked incredibly well together. And I think that was the power of the team, that Ross could concentrate at least most of the time on, you know, the technical side and, you know, trying to put together a car, which we had to do on a shoestring. You know, I could concentrate very much on, you know, potential investors and trying to raise some money. And Caroline, the lawyer, and Nigel, the finance director, and John, the HR director, could concentrate on, you know, doing their jobs brilliantly. But everyone, I think, did a very good job individually. But I think the power of it was that the five of us were together incredibly strongly. And I think, you know, I know it's a sort of hackneyed thing to say that people talk about teamwork, but when it's you're in that situation, or Formula One generally, it is all about the team. And you know, the best people that I've worked with, and Michael Schumacher would be you know, very high up on that list, really understood the power of pulling the team together and everyone working well together. And I think we were just the epitome of great teamwork.
In those sort of dog days, the winter of 2008-2009, you must have known, or at least had an inkling, that you had a decent car, even though designers and engineers routinely exaggerate how good they are. You mentioned later in the book that Ron Dennis rang you up and wanted to know your aero numbers. You know, were you that confident yourself that you had a great car just parked waiting to run?
No, not at all. I mean, we felt that, you know, we really jacked in the 2008 season. I mean, it was clear that the car wasn't going to be good enough. And although you can't completely give up, after we got Ross on board, the focus was really on 2009. The focus was on the regulation changes. And we knew that if we started work on that earlier than the others, then that might give us a bit of an advantage. Internally, the objective was to be top three. When Honda pulled out and decided they didn't want to sell us or let us have the engine, you know, even on a purchase basis, you know, we definitely reduced our target. We thought, well, if we can get kind of into the top half, we might be doing well. So we really, you know, genuinely did not know how quick the car was. And the simulations that were done, the computer simulations, frankly, we didn't believe. I mean, there was some work done which indicated we were like a second and a half quicker than all the others at the start of testing, which obviously we didn't participate in the start of testing. So we could only kind of look at what we've got from our aero numbers and sort of make a guesstimate, and the numbers were discarded as ridiculous because they were so good. And it was only when we did a little test around Silverstone in terrible conditions, literally under a sort of a garden awning. I mean, that was the sort of level we were working at, with you know, about 10 engineers under you know, something that you'd you know, you'd have three friends around to have a picnic. And then when we got to Barcelona to the first test, and it was just like the first lap, it was just unbelievable. I mean, it was really only then, because you don't let yourself believe that you can be that good. But we were even better than the numbers showed, because when we realised how quick we were kind of putting weight in the car to slow down to try and sandbag a bit. But even then, we were still you know, first and second in that last test.
And you still weren't home at all, were you? Because you were operating on a hugely reduced budget. Now, let me get the facts right. You, in effect, bought the company for £1, but taking on the liabilities, is that?
We couldn't find any acceptable buyer. And as I say, Honda deserve great credit, because they weren't just willing to offload it. And their view, quite rightly, was, you know, well, we may as well take our pain and shut it down rather than sell it to someone who is inappropriate, and then we're going to kind of have a lot of grief thereafter. So, I mean, Ross and I were seen as probably the best of a bad lot, which sums it up. And, you know, we bought it for £1 on the basis that we just took it as it was with, you know, all the people that we had. So, you know, obviously the first job, sadly, was to cut back, you know, massively. I think we went from 700-odd people to about 400 virtually overnight, which meant we were running on an absolute shoestring. I mean, I would be the bad guy most of the time and, you know, literally sit down there, you know, person by person and work out who we could afford to send to races. And, you know, that included not sending myself in many cases. And, you know, Ross and I tried to, you know, be the best possible team members by doing what we expected everyone else to do. So we spent a lot of time on EasyJet.
Yeah, that's another thing that comes over from the book, isn't it? The amount of time you spent on EasyJet flights, which can't have been pleasant because it's not like that for anyone else.
Well, you know, it's a kind of it brings it home that, you know, on the one hand, we were standing on the podium receiving a trophy and, you know, 3 hours later, we would be on the 11 o'clock flight to Luton in seat 35D. With the rest of the fans, which frankly was great fun. It was great fun for the fans that were around us, and it was good for us. But we did have to endure, 1 o'clock in the morning at Luton in a queue of 200, 300 people waiting to get through passport control. But it does you good to
with
a trophy under your arm. But it's good for you, being brought back down to earth.
That must have been quite tricky, actually. I remember in my years covering the European Le Mans Series, one driver took his tried to get the trophy on the plane with him, and the security were having none of it, and he told them he had his grandma's ashes in it.
Well, I mean, word gets around quite quickly, and I have to say we were well looked after in that, you know, this ridiculously small team that had been on death's door starting to be successful. And I have to say, you know, even airlines and, you know, passport officers and, you know, invariably I was the last one to leave England to go to races. So, you know, what happens in a Formula One team is all those last minute bits get dumped on the last person to go. So invariably I ended up, you know, having discussions with customs officers, or what's in this? Or it's Jenson Button's seat. And, you know, but we were indulged and everyone thought it was very amusing. And it was just a time of a great challenge, but great camaraderie.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into that, because around that time, and this is something else people might not know and won't know until they've read your book, is that very quickly you went from having entertained a few sort of no-hopers, weirdos, chancers, freaks, losers, oddballs, into getting very serious offers from, let's say, better known entities. And one of whom was Bernie Eccleston, who went from kind of wanting the whole team killed with fire to wanting to buy it. And you come up with this fascinating exchange where you go into Bernie's office and his opening gambit is, Max says, you'll see you next Tuesday.
Dealing with Bernie is endlessly entertaining, and you know, laughing aside, he's an incredibly impressive character to have had to deal with, and you learn a lot when you work with someone like that. But I mean, what one of the other sort of layers, which, you know, frankly the book doesn't bore people with too much, but, you know, as well as everything else going on, this was a time when the teams were trying to negotiate, you know, a new commercial contract. And what tends to happen then is it's a bit like you know, a public vote. The more, you know, people on one side, and Ferrari were in those days certainly invariably on you know, Bernie's side, because he gave them the most money to be on his side. So that was kind of fairly straightforward. But then the game was how many others you could get on kind of your side to vote for Bernie's point of view. So one of the mechanisms that Bernie tried was, you know, suggesting that he would buy the team from us. And so we had a very entertaining, rather rude conversation in that typical Bernie fashion. He wanted the team, but he didn't want to pay much for it. So I got dispatched from his office with, I think his words were, if you effing well think you can do it yourself, go and do that. And so we did, I guess. But Bernie was one that expressed a level of interest, and the others, which was a very nice conversation, was with the Glazer family, who obviously had Manchester United, and with Alex Ferguson, and you know, they had, I think, the very good idea of you know, having Ross Brawn as an icon of our industry and Sir Alex as an icon, you know, kind of together in the same portfolio, there would have been potential economies from getting sponsorship. You know, and Manchester United are a machine as far as the commercial side, and that would have worked very nicely for two entities. So there was a lot of logic to it, and I think from the conversations we had with Ed Woodwards, who's now the chairman of Man U, who's a fantastically you know, bright character, I think from a personal point of view, it would have been great fun. But the problem was that Mercedes clearly were a better bet with a proven Formula One engine, and a football team doesn't have one of those. So this, we did the sensible thing, which was selling the team to Mercedes. I think there's a tremendous temptation to try and carry on because, you know, we've been very successful. We'd you know, beaten all the odds. Everyone thought we were wonderful. But the reality is the two private individuals can't carry on running a Formula One team. And I think, sadly, what has happened subsequently were even great teams like Williams and McLaren have you know, fallen by the wayside a bit, really shows that unless you've got the backing of you know, Ferrari and Fiat Group and that huge entity, or Mercedes-Benz or Red Bull, frankly, you've got no chance. And the fact that I think I'm right in saying every race for the last 5 years has been won by three teams, you know, shows that it's money that counts at the end of the day.
The way that the commercial settlement works in Formula One is, firstly, throughout 09 you weren't getting a great deal of money because the team's poor finishing positions the years before, but also, even though you were being successful, it wasn't as if 1st of January 2010 you were going to get a huge check through the door, was it? You get that money in stages. Is it 11 months of the year or something like that?
So yeah, you do get paid with the benefit of hindsight, with you know, looking backwards, as it were, unless you go begging to Bernie and ask for a you know, some support, but so that usually comes with a price as well. So probably not the best thing to do. But you know, it was pretty clear that we would really struggle to continue, and we'd really mortgage the future by putting everything we had pretty much into 2009. So we went into 2010, fortunately, with the backing of Mercedes-Benz, but you know, pretty lean, which might have been okay if the budget cuts, which 10 years later are still being talked about, had been implemented. But you know, it didn't get the support that it needed. I think that if the budget cuts which had been proposed at that time had been implemented, we might have had a chance. But as we went through 2009, it became increasingly clear that that was unlikely. You know, Mercedes are a great company. They've just got great resources in Formula One. The engine's absolutely wonderful and still is, and they're good to deal with. So, you know, we made exactly the right decision, and you know, I think what's happened subsequently has proven that you know, how good the team was, but also how good the team is, and credit to them for continuing with great performance.
I'll circle back to the issue of budget caps a bit later if I may, but just while we're kind of on the subject of the Glazers and Mercedes, I was actually very surprised at how torn you were in the book when you say that, you know, there was a meeting and you sort of discussed which offer to entertain. Because with my limited understanding of football and its business, because I'm more of a rugby fan, my understanding was always that the Glazers, it was a leveraged buyout. It was a bit unpopular at the time. It saddled the business with a lot of debt. And okay, so they do well commercially, but it was quite a risk. So I was, when I first read about them in the context of owning an F1 team, I kind of thought, well, maybe that's not necessarily a great business proposition. And yet it did seem like you and the team were genuinely torn which offer to go with.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was sort of the votes that I talk about in the book between one and the other was sort of semi-jokey, I would say. But, you know, from a personal point of view, you know, when you've run a company even for a relatively short period of time yourselves, and you're very fleet on your feet. I mean, I remember having a conversation with Ross where he said, you know, even at Ferrari, he had the feeling that someone was looking over his shoulder and checking, you know, whether he was making the right decisions. And, you know, for 2009, I think part of the beauty of the situation was, you know, Ross and I had a controlling interest, you know, of the team. And, you know, if something went wrong and we made the wrong decision, you know, we'd sit usually in my office, which was somewhat more comfortable than Ross's at that time, and just kind of have a bit of a laugh and say, well, we won't do that again, will we? And you'd move on. But there was none of the sort of recriminations or having to justify what you did. And I think that freedom actually, you know, certainly on the pit wall for Ross and the guys, you know, helped a lot, so that we could make decisions without feeling that we had to explain to anyone. It was only us, and, you know, we had enough money in the bank at least to keep us going until the end of the season. So we didn't have a bank manager even that we had to discuss things with. So it was a very unique situation. And when you meet someone like the Glazers, who, you know, delegate a lot to Ed and his team, you're kind of talking to kindred spirits. So I think there was a, you know, a liking from that point of view, but from the point of view of what is the right thing to do for the company and the employees and the suppliers and everyone else you have to deal with, then there's no doubt that, you know, going with Mercedes-Benz was the correct business decision.
Ross comes over in the book as being a spectacularly no-nonsense character. You get quite a lot of that when you interview him in real life. He's always very guarded, though. Is he like that sort of behind the scenes?
His great skill is that he is a great team player. And it's very clear with Ross, and he's got a great family, and they're a very tight-knit family. But he, I think, runs the Formula One team in exactly the same way. And there's an expectation that, you know, if you're going to have a discussion or an argument, that's fine, but you have it, you know, in the room together. It doesn't go outside the room, and you make a decision, you get on with it, and you operate as a team. He's a lovely person to deal with, and he's not tough to deal with, but he's very good at his job. And I think the people in Formula One, almost across the board, are very good at what they do. And I came from the outside, from the car industry, didn't know quite what to expect. You think, well, you know, you're with a bunch of you know, people who have a great life traveling around the world and having a nice life spending other people's money. But I think what you quickly find, you know, pretty much across the board, is that whether it's a marketing person, whether it's a finance person or a purchasing person or whatever they might be, they are very good. And that is the only bit of Formula One, really, that I miss, is working with just fantastic people. And, you know, Ross is the pinnacle of the engineering team. But he's not difficult to work with, but he expects, you know, people to work together. And it's no nonsense, but it's a pleasurable experience.
I was fascinated to read as well that as part of that business of not having vast quantities of other people's money to spend anymore, you had to institute some quite tight financial regulation. So any purchase of more than 75 quid had to be signed off by you or Ross or Nigel Kurt. Now, as managers, that must have been quite an undertaking, because one of you had to be available at any time to sign off one of these checks.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you know, everyone realises that in most companies, you know, budgets are set at the beginning of the year, and then the department heads or whoever they are, you know, that's their responsibility to spend that money. And we quickly decided, well, you know, the best way to control it wasn't to give any money to anyone. We would just approve everything ourselves. And we had, you know, a funny experience I had with Ron Meadows, the team manager, fairly early on, where he came to my office and made the mistake of saying he wanted to buy something, and said it's only 100 quid. And I said, well, if it's only 100 quid, you won't mind paying out of your salary then, because it's our bloody money. And you know, and I think the key to it, you couldn't do that on an ongoing basis, I don't think. But under this crisis situation, it was just a matter of making decisions very quickly. And and I think once you got over the initial shock that there wasn't any money, and we were, literally, you know, working on every 100 quid. I mean, in most Formula One teams, you know, everything comes in hundreds of thousands or millions. So, you know, it was a bit of a shock to the team to be working to such tight budgets to start with. But once everyone got into the swing of it, I think it worked reasonably well. But it did rely on one of the three of us making a decision very quickly. And I think, again, it was the power of working together and trusting each other which took us through the crisis.
Did you have to carry on with that all year, even while you were entertaining advances from people like the Glazers, Tony Fernandez, you mentioned as well, and Mercedes? Because you say, you know, that was March after the Australian Grand Prix, you first got interest from these people, but you didn't get the deal over the line with Mercedes until the end of the year. So presumably that was quite a big financial no man's land you had to tread through before the buyout then took place.
Yeah, we were eking out the money as much as we could, because we had no idea what the future held. I mean, maybe, you know, the knight in shining armour would not appear, in which case, you know, we had what we had. And the idea was to how far into 2010 could we get before we went belly up. And the finances were done in an incredibly simplistic way. I mean, we knew roughly, you know, what budget we had, which was relatively or very small. You know, we cut back the number of people dramatically. And frankly, the going in position was, you know, we need to pay off everyone at the end of the 2009 season on the same terms that Honda had given people. Or we had the, yeah, if we'd have closed down the team, Honda would have paid people fairly generously. They would have paid them probably above the state minimum, which was the appropriate thing to do. So Ross and I felt that if we closed down at the end of the 2009 season, we had a moral obligation to pay people as they would have been paid a year earlier. So we kind of put that money aside, as it were, to give to people if the worst came to the worst. And what we had left was the budgets. And I think, if I remember rightly, up until the summer shutdown, I think on the development of the car, we spent about £600,000 in total. Now, at that time, you know, Red Bull was rumoured to be spending, you know, $1 or $2 million per race on development parts, etc. And, you know, we knew they were all going to catch up from a technical point of view, because, you know, they were able to throw so much money at it. So we turned the tap down as far as we could until really the summer shutdown. And then it became clear the others were catching up very quickly. And, you know, Jensen was having a wobble or two. And so we turned the tap on briefly to give us a few more parts to make the thing go a bit more quickly. But it was a matter of spending the minimum we possibly could to get the thing across the line in championship winning position, and then have as much as we could in our back pocket to see us through to whatever was on the other side. And we really didn't know what was on the other side. So, you know, it was a matter of saving as much as possible.
Yeah, I think just flicking through my notes, you said it was a matter of going from basically a £200 million annual budget to two, which is more than the third you were talking about earlier, wasn't it? That's very, very drastic, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, but and that's really why in the following year especially, we did relatively poorly. You know, we simply had not been able to invest in anything. I mean, in a Formula One team, normally you have one team working on the current car and you have another team of people, or at least a smaller team, but somebody working on the future. And we couldn't afford to have anyone working on the future to any great extent. So, you know, when the budget cuts didn't come into action, you know, we were left pretty much high and dry with a car that, you know, had suffered from, you know, pretty much no development.
Obviously, our listeners, readers in the magazine, when they read the interview that comes from this, will know how the season panned out. The turn of phrase you use in the book, possibly coming from the journalistic pen of your co-author, is that Jensen made rather heavy weather of it. Tell me if I'm being unfair here. You say you had a sort of kind of a creative loss of temper, temperature. You had a creative loss of temper with Richard Goddard at your meeting about his ongoing contract or his not ongoing contract. I kind of got the impression that you felt that you were better off without him in a way. Is that fair to say?
I think that would be unfair. I mean, I think that, you know, the team and you know, me as an individual, we've been with Jensen for a long time and we've been through a lot. I mean, not only just poor performance of the Honda car and kind of getting through that, but also, you know, Button Gate 1 and 2, I think it was called at the time, Jensen signed contracts, you know, with another team that we, you know, frankly helped him get out of in a pretty generous way.
It's almost like a season ticket loan that some of our listeners might have from their employer.
Exactly. I mean, exactly the same thing. And I think that, you know, and he became world champion, and fair dues to him. He's a very good driver, but we had a very good car as well. And I think that to jump ship, you know, in the way that he did, you know, didn't maybe reflect the help that we'd given him over the years. And, you know, my attitude to people leaving, you know, the company that you run is, when you feel that they're doing the right thing and you can't compete, then good luck to them. So when someone's going to a better job with much more money than you can offer, but, you know, my feeling at the time, and I think sadly it was proven out by the realities, is that, you know, he was making a poor decision, frankly, as he had done, you know, on a couple of occasions before when we had to bail him out. So, you know, he and I, you know, when we do talk or see each other from time to time, it's perfectly cordial. But I kind of get left with the feeling of what might have been and what might have been there for Jensen, because, you know, he's a lovely guy. He's a great guy to work with. We worked together for a long time. And if he had stayed with the team and seen it out, you never know, he may have been world champion more than once. And I think, I can't remember how many races he won with McLaren, but he won a few. But generally it all kind of petered out, which is sad. And, you know, I think when you write a book like this, you know, there are a lot of, you know, what might have been. And, you know, Jensen going was a disappointment. And I did give him and his manager the sharp edge of my tongue in a fairly, you know, dramatic fashion, which is detailed in the book. And I think Jensen spoke about it a little bit as well in his book. But, you know, it would have been nice to have won some more with Jensen. But indeed, it would have been nice if we'd have won with Michael.
There might have been no Michael Schumacher comeback if Jensen had stayed, mightn't there? Because you were fairly fixed on Nico Rosberg for the other seat. You decided that Rubens was sort of a figure of the past. And that, to me, is very interesting. Because at the time, there was this feeling that Nico was something of a journeyman, or in some ways, you know, he'd shown good form in qualifying a lot, but then, you know, he'd been a little bit indifferent in what had been quite a few seasons with Williams. And I know in the book you say people view him as kind of being someone who was just there because of his dad. My impression of him, maybe from a different perspective, is his dad tried to keep out of his business quite a lot. So maybe that's a notion you can shoot down as well. What was it you saw in Nico?
Yeah, I mean, some of your colleagues were incredibly negative, and you know, made it clear to me that I was making a really dumb decision in hiring Nico. But I think you have to look at people and their skill sets. And I know there's recently been some people saying, you know, bad things about Nico. But I think some drivers have immense natural talents, but maybe they're not as bright as you know, others, or maybe they're not as hardworking. And there are people like Nico who still has an incredible level of talents. I mean, I think the difficulty of all these conversations is that you're talking about a 2% difference is the reality. I mean, the difference between, you know, a genius like Lewis Hamilton and, you know, another Formula One driver who's still capable of winning races or even wins the world championship is relatively small. But it's enough to make the difference. It's why does, you know, Ronaldo or Messi score a goal when others can't? It's just that, you know, that natural brilliance. But these people are all incredibly good. And it's almost, I find it unfair to talk about them as one's better than the other, because they are, but they're all still at the top of their game. And I think Nico's a great driver, but what Nico, I think, brings along is a great degree of intelligence. I mean, I think I'm right in saying he could have gone to Imperial College in London to study engineering. engineering, if I remember rightly, and that comes through. He has different attributes, and you know, his dad had very little to do with you know, him coming to our team, and I think that's impressive unto itself. I mean, with some drivers, and I've had numerous over the years, who come along with you know, the manager and you know, the army behind them. And when I first met Nico to discuss his contracts, Lord March kindly gave us a room upstairs somewhere at the Goodwill Festival of Speed, and you know, Nico turned up by himself, and you know, but he's got the brains to do that, and some of them have. And Sebastian Loeb, when I was in rallying, was another one who was very impressive. In that, although at that time his English wasn't good at all, he turned up by himself. And when I said, you know, who manages you, it was, well, I get some advice from Mum and Dad, who are school teachers. And you know, I think Nico's got a huge range of skill, and just to sort of criticise him on the basis that he may be not the natural driver that maybe Lewis is really missing the point. He has a range of skills which got him to be world champion, just as Jensen did.
And in the book, you say that ultimately you ended up getting more out of Michael Schumacher than he got out of you as Mercedes. So maybe this is an appropriate juncture to kind of tie off the ongoing development, the resource restriction agreement, but also talk a little bit about what Michael Schumacher brought to the renamed Mercedes team. What he brought to Nico as well, because I hear a fantastic story, and you can tell me whether it's true or not, or whether you'd even heard it, but there was a story, I think, in China one year. Obviously, drivers like to relieve themselves before practice or qualifying or whatever the session is. And there is one toilet which Michael went and made sure he occupied before this vitally important session, while there's Nico kind of banging on the door to be let in to use the bog. And eventually the engineers call Nico away saying, no, you must get in the car now. So he has to then do that session with an unemptied bladder, and that was his sort of crash course in Michael Schumacher mind games. Now, firstly, do you know if that's true?
Or I have no idea if that's true. I would be surprised if it is, because I think that people like to characterise, especially in the UK, you know, or certainly did like to characterise, you know, Michael as this sort of dastardly German who played all sorts of tricks. And I can honestly say I didn't see that. You know, what I saw was someone who was very good at being a great team player. And, you know, I think I've seen, you know, both sides of the coin. You know, and I'll be frank about this. My introduction to Formula One was working with Jacques Villeneuve, who, you know, seemed at that time to take great delight in walking to the car with his helmet on, so he didn't have to talk to anyone and didn't really seem to have much relationship with a lot of the mechanics, or even know who the hell they were. Whereas Michael was the other end of the scale. You know, he was genuinely the person who realised that, you know, in order for him to perform at the highest level, he had to get everyone else to perform at the highest level. And that's why he was so immensely successful over a long period of time. And, you know, I'd like to think that, you know, when Lewis comes on the radio at the end of a race and thanks the team, he's not doing that for the benefit of PR. He knows full well that unless the 1,000 people or whatever it is now at Brackley are all doing their job perfectly, he ain't going to win. And I think Michael really understood that. And I didn't see any particular, you know, mind games or silliness between the two drivers. In fact, quite the opposite. I, you know, saw almost a fatherly approach, you know, from Michael. And I think, you know, these drivers who are later on in their career have got immense experience. You know, frankly, although they want to beat their teammate, you know, they're also realised that, you know, sooner or later they're going to stop driving and the other guy is going to. So you're almost sort of handing over bits of your knowledge. And I think that, you know, when all is said and done with Michael Schumacher, you know, I think he'll be on an even higher pedestal than he is in most people's minds now.
Yeah, you do mention that the experience of working with Michael kind of turned Nico from a potential race winner into an actual championship winner, don't you? And everything he learned, he sort of banked. And during that, so was it, I mean, 2016, isn't it? He went to his crew and said, I'm not as fast as Lewis, but if we do it this way, we can win.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think others, you know, I think have said the same. I don't know the relationship between Sebastian Vettel and Michael, but I think Sebastian has learned a lot. And I think the intelligent ones do. You know, they're looking around and seeing, you know, what does that guy do well? And, you know, how can I, you know, how can I replicate that and how can it help me? And, you know, I think Michael was a master of Formula One.
I'm very amused also to learn that your first approach to him was in the Amber Lounge party.
Yeah, we thought we'd give it a go. I mean, when it was clear that, you know, things weren't going well with Jensen, that his aspiration for salary was well in excess of, you know, what we thought was reasonable. You know, we were pretty stuck, to be honest. It was late in the year. You know, there were some, you know, decent drivers. You know, Nick Heidfeld was doing very well at the time. You know, he was certainly on the consideration set, but, you know, there wasn't the superstar, you know, there. And, you know, I think Ross and I had a couple of beers and Michael was there. And, I said to Ross, you know, he's your mate, go and have a chat and let's see. And, you know, 5 minutes later, Ross came back beaming and said, you know, he's up for a chat. And just it was a great moment. And, you know, and him driving for us was incredible. Just the disappointment is, you know, although we got one podium, I think, you know, he never won, which really for me would have been, you know, the icing on the cake.
What do you think he brought to Mercedes that wasn't there when you initially made the transfer to Mercedes and Braun GP became Mercedes GP and you began 2010 with a pretty much undeveloped car?
Michael just brings an intensity and an ability or a willingness to work incredibly hard. And, you know, those discussions of, you know, briefings and debriefings, which are hour upon hour upon hour of, you know, just unrelentlessly, you know, looking at how we could do better. He takes, you know, even later in his career, you know, he took to, you know, a different level. And, you know, most of the drivers, especially if you've done, ironically, when you've done well in a race, you know, and maybe you've won, the temptation is to have a quick debrief and everyone goes off and, you know, has a beer or gets a plane or do whatever they're going to do. And, you know, I think what you find in Formula One and in business in general, you've really got to capture the experience then. Leaving it till the Monday morning is too late. It's really, you've got to capture as much information on what went wrong, what went right. And, you know, Michael's willingness as a, you know, a multi-millionaire having won, you know, 7 world championships, his willingness to sit there for 3-4 hours was unprecedented. And I think that, you know, a lot of the other drivers have obviously, you know, picked up on that willingness to knuckle down.
Yeah. Was that something that wasn't happening before, do you think?
It happened before, but I think not to the same extent.
One of the threads that I promised we'd pick up on, and we're now at the right part in the timeline to talk about it, is the kind of the push towards resource restriction. Now, at the beginning of 2010, you were going into that championship, ostensibly a much higher budget operation because you'd got the Petronas sponsorship, you had Mercedes ownership, you had the slightly strange sludge grey rather than silver file car, but you hadn't had that development in season, so you'd actually probably by that point technically fallen behind rivals, particularly Red Bull, who'd been spending all that money.
Yeah, I mean, one of my, you know, I'm a Formula One fan at the end of the day, and before I, you know, happened to find you know, myself in charge of a team, you know, I've been a Formula One fan and went with my dad when I was sort of 12, 13 years old. And I think the frustration is that, you know, everyone knows what needs to be done. And the situation at the moment, which again, you know, Ross and Liberty Media are trying to resolve, is making it a little bit fairer. And when you have a situation where, you know, a number of the teams, a small number of the teams, get the lion's share of the rewards, as well as having the best backing, as well as having the best drivers, as well as having the best, you know, resources. And then you practice the cars for a couple of days, line them up on the grid with the fastest at the front and the slowest at the back. You know, surprise, surprise, you end up with, you know, the inevitable result. And unless that's broken down, it's difficult to see how that radically changes. And for a, you know, a sport where only three competitors have won in a long time, that is a pretty, you know, miserable situation. I think that, you know, the unfair distribution of income needs to be addressed, and clearly that's a tough call for those who get the most money. And, you know, the fact that, you know, someone mentioned to me that, you know, Brackley now there are, you know, 1,200 people. You know, that is an incredible amount of money that is being spent on human beings just for the chassis alone, as well as the probably 800 or 1,000 people working on the engine. And frankly, you know, you can't compete with that. And unless there is a top-down approach, I'm not sure how you resolve it. And, you know, it's not in the book, but, you know, I remember, you know, during the course of 2009 into 2010, having a chat on the phone with Jean Todt and kind of pleading with him to, you know, really sort this out and dictate what needed to be done in the same way as probably Max will have done it. And, you know, I think there's almost 10 lost years. And yes, the team that I was lucky enough to own and run has continued to do brilliantly, and that's fantastic in one way. But I do think that from a fan's point of view, things could have been different if the income had been spread more fairly, and if the cost of competing had been a bit more moderate.
Because that was a crucial time, wasn't it? 2010, you had FOTA, as it was then, that was becoming quite powerful. I mean, is it fair to say FOTA was kind of on the glide path towards Bernie kind of killing it off by then? Because it had become a bit of a thorn in Bernie's side, hadn't it? And FOTA was very for resource restrictions. And Ross has said in some interviews he's done that arguably one of the reasons for Mercedes not exploding out of the box in its recent in its new form from 2010, 2011 onwards, was that you were kind of trying to work towards this resource restriction agreement budget. Yep. And you were the poster boys for it, weren't you? You'd slimmed down.
No, absolutely.
So you were the example, but somehow Bernie managed to chip away the resolve of the other teams and it became every man for himself again.
Yeah, I mean, the thing you have to understand when you run a Formula One team, you are paid to do a job, and the job you are paid to do is to win. And frankly, I mean, and this is, you know, some people will say, oh, you know, this is the root cause of the problem. But, you know, when you're paid to win and you're employed to win, that's what you do. And the fortunes of your team have to come before the fortunes of the sports. And it's kind of, it's funny to watch from the outside how people's attitudes change. And, you know, if I can sort of pick on Red Bull and Christian and
please do
a little bit. I mean, at one stage it's, you know, wanting, you know, a fairer distribution and you know, some of those restrictions to be in place. But as soon as you get a car manufacturer behind you, in this case Honda, you know, Honda's attitude is, I think, you know, certainly in the days I worked with them, was that if there were no rules at all, that would be a good thing. You know, if it was, you know, not even prescribing the number of cylinders in the engine for a very technical company that just loves engineering and is very strong on that side, that would have been a very appealing type of Formula One. But the budgets would have gone completely through the roof. And, you know, when you've got money, you know, you're very in favour of, you know, it being a very high cost sport because it plays to your strengths that you've got the money and you're going to do better because of that. But, you know, when you haven't got any money, of course, you argue the opposite. And it's kind of amusing to watch from the outside people's views change very quickly depending on which side of the fence they're on.
How difficult was it, having kind of sold Mercedes on this low-cost, relatively low-risk vision of being competitive in F1, how difficult was it to then have to go back to them and persuade them to spend a bit more, saying, sorry, I'm afraid Red Bull, Christian, etc. have driven a coach and horses through the RRA. We're going to need a bigger boat, basically.
I mean, I think a company like Mercedes are realists, and they've been involved in Formula One for a long, long time. So, I mean, they kind of understood. They may not have liked it, but they understood, you know, the name of the game. But the problem was that we had underinvested, and then had a a hard time for a couple of years catching up again, because those people, some of those important people that we'd let go, we were on a massive, you know, hiring spree. You know, I hired a human resources person specifically to a senior human resources people specifically to rehire engineers, and we went on a, you know, a mission to get back, you know, some of those talented people that that we'd lost or had to let go at the beginning of 2009. But these people, you know, in many cases were, you know, employed with other teams, or they'd found other jobs or what have you. So it was slow work. So I think it really took us, you know, a good couple of years. I mean, if I remember rightly, the next race win was 2013, if I remember rightly. Was it China then?
It might be 12, actually.
Was it 12? China, okay, yeah. It took us a couple of years to get back, you know, at least to, you know, a race-winning position again. So it just shows that if you do fall behind, then it's bloody difficult to pick things up again.
What was it like going from owner to being an employee again? Was that a difficult cultural change?
Difficult, yes, but I think you have to be a big boy or a big girl in those situations. I mean, we had decided to sell the team. The team had become the property of someone else. And, you know, you have to be respectful that it's, you know, it's their toy, and they wanted to run it in a certain way with certain people. And, you know, I think when you know, neither Ross and I are new to business, you have to be very realistic that things are going to change, and things are going to change dramatically. But I think the one of the reasons that Mercedes is so successful in running a Formula One team is that they don't impose their view in the same way that perhaps I saw with Toyota or even with Honda. I mean, the Mercedes attitude certainly at that time was, look, you know, we will show you the resources that we've got. They're at your disposal, but it's your choice. We're not going to force them on you. It's your choice whether you use them. Now, in brackets, you could write, but if you don't, and if you're not successful, then, you know, the consequences might not be too pleasant. But they don't try and run the team, and so I think, you know, they understand Formula One, and they are good Formula One team owners, and, you know, they've developed one hell of a Formula One engine, which is, you know, at least you know, part of the key to it.
Did you ever get an impression that they were getting a little bit impatient for success? Because the impression we got was that first Nicky and then Toto were sort of brought in because there was a little bit of worrying that you'd only got the one win by that point. Sort of.
Yeah, I'm absolutely. Yeah, I mean, everyone wants to win, you know, that day, that week. And it was frustrating that, you know, we weren't successful for a couple of years. And, you know, they wanted to bring in their own people. I mean, you know, realistically, when we sold the team, I think you think, well, you know, if this lasts 3 years, then, you know, we'd be doing pretty well, because they want to do things in their own way. And I think that's entirely natural and, you know, to be expected. And I think the lovely thing is that, you know, I think everyone won out of this. I mean, you know, Ross and I got a nice world championship, and, you know, we sold the team for more than we bought it for, which was very nice. Mercedes have got a fantastic team, which has continued to do, you know, brilliantly well. The employees have got a, you know, great employer, and, you know, I'm sure a lot of them have, or a number of them have become millionaires off the back of it. So, you know, good for them. And, you know, I know full well that if I, you know, sat here now and sent a text to you know, Ola Calais, the new boss of Mercedes, who, you know, ran AMG for you know, a good while, and ran the engine facility that makes the Formula One, you know, we get a response, or I get a response, you know, very quickly. And, you know, I think there's a good relationship, and everyone, you know, looks back on the whole transaction and what's happened, you know, fondly.
Another sort of profound influence you've had on the shape of the team now came from very, very strange circumstances. You mentioned the book, a clandestine meeting in the park with Simon Fuller over sandwiches. And at the end of that particular journey, you employed Lewis Hamilton, who's on his way to becoming one of the most successful drivers. Well, he's already one of the most successful drivers of all time. May, before he retires, become the most successful driver of all time. But at that point was someone who was having a troubled relationship with his employer, and who, let's face it, Ron doesn't come out in his rare appearances as one of your dramatis personae. He doesn't come out brilliantly, does he, Nick?
I think the points I wanted to make in the Lewis Hamilton chapter was to sort of really show that these things don't happen overnight. I mean, the discussions with Lewis had gone, you know, way before that. You know, Gilles de Ferran, who was our sporting director at one stage, you know, the famous Indy 500 winner, you know, had supper, some pasta cooked by Gilles at his house in Oxford before Lewis got into Formula One, to discuss, you know, if McLaren, you know, didn't give him the Formula One seats, then, you know, we were sort of standing by in the wings, and I'm sure that Lewis and Anthony saw you know, a number of others. But, you know, I think it took, you know, several years for the Lewis thing to come together. And frankly, and I know Ross has said this, but, you know, credit to Niki Lauda, because we've been struggling a little bit to persuade Mercedes that that Lewis was the right person for the team. And, you know, I'm sure the majority of that was, even at that stage, a fairly eye-watering salary bill. And, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, I've worked for a long time in car companies, and, you know, it's difficult for the chief executive of a huge corporation, and I think Mercedes is possibly the 12th best-known brand in the world, somewhere up there, to sign off a check to someone who's driving a damn racing car and having the time of their lives and sign off a salary which is a multiple of their own. I mean, there's a famous story in Ford that I think it was Edsel Ford asked for a ranked listing of the highest paid employees, and the highest was, you know, E. Irvine.
Oh yeah, who the hell is Ed Irvine?
Who the hell is Ed Irvine? And you know, it's that type of shock of, you know, we're paying these people to drive around in circles more than, and it was Niki that came along, and when he was appointed chairman, he and I were chewing the cud over drivers, and I went through this long tale of this courtship with Lewis, and Niki, God bless him, just said, you know, go and hire him, and we'll ask for forgiveness later. And that's what we went away and did.
That's a very Niki Lauda thing, isn't it? Sort of just do it, whatever it takes to become successful.
Yeah, I mean, it's been humbling to see close to some of these incredibly impressive figures, which, as we discussed earlier, from the outside look flawed characters, because they are flawed characters, because you don't get that good at anything and you don't succeed unless you're a bit kind of kooky and have got some maybe some foibles on the other side. But you know, spending a little bit of time with Niki, and, you know, one of the really and everyone knows the story of what happened to Niki at the Nürburgring, but you know, and I knew the story as well as anyone else, but when you hear Niki Lauda tell that story, and at this time it was the run up to the Hunt versus Lauda movie, and Niki did had a discussion with someone from the outside in my office, and just said to me, I'll just sit there and you know, you can listen, it's no problem. And to hear it firsthand from the person who went through what he did is extraordinary, and these people are phenomenally impressive. And just to be able to work or have worked with a little bit with Niki, and you know, clearly Bernie and some of the other people, and indeed Ron, and you know, the stories in the book maybe Ron won't appreciate too much, but you know, Ron's, you know, to achieve what he achieved from very humble beginnings to you know, a company which is now worth you know, probably several billion, is an incredible achievement.
Formula One is a sport populated by high achievers, isn't it? Not exclusively, because I think what one thing we can end on in terms of the recruitment of Lewis is that you did get some pushback from Mercedes, not just about his salary, but they would have preferred Nick Heidfeld, and you're quite waspish about him. You say he's even sending me pictures of his wife and his dogs and stuff.
Well,
and it's clear that he's never in the same class as Lewis.
No. I think it's unfair to say that they preferred Nick, who, you know, was at that time and still is a very good driver. But I think it was just the balking at, you know, probably an eye-watering bill that came with it. And, you know, maybe there was other stuff that I didn't know about that had gone on, you know, in their relationship when he was at McLaren. And, you know, I didn't know about any of that stuff. But, you know, there were a number of occasions where we got sent back to, you know, what alternatives are there? So I think it's unfair to interpret it as they preferred Nick. It was just maybe they didn't like the size of the Lewis check.
Now, post Formula One, you've gone and done loads of other stuff, very exciting things. Your cut of the takings of the book is going to charity, so I'm presuming that you don't need to go and work as an author and you're ticking along quite nicely. Would you be prepared to come back to Formula One if you had the right offer? Do you need to work, if that's not too impertinent a question?
I think... It would be a bit like going back to an old girlfriend, probably, you know, maybe in some respects appealing, but probably, you know, not the right thing to do. And I think you can't relive those times. And, you know, with due respect to, you know, some of the people who hang around Formula One forever, you know, that's not me. You know, and I've come from a completely different background. I mean, Formula One was part of my career. You know, I had a career in the mainstream car industry, you know, before that with Ford and Aston Martin, and, you know, obviously did the rallying with Subaru and sports cars with Ferrari and, you know, Bathurst with Ford, etc. So I had a life before Formula One, and, you know, I'm incredibly grateful that I had those, you know, 12 years, I think it was in the end, from start to finish in Formula One. But that was just part of my life, and you know, one that I, you know, I'm incredibly pleased to have had. But you know, there's always a future, and I've been the type of person who always looks forward. So, you know, after, you know, we finished with Mercedes, there were various suggestions, but you know, it's a big wide world. There's a lot of stuff out there which is really interesting, and you know, I'm chairman of, among other things, an esports team, Fnatic, you know, at the moment. And I've got about 15 other, maybe more, other business interests in different fields. And, you know, you carry on learning, and you, you know, learn different things. And, you know, I'd be reluctant to go around the same circle.
It's always useful to know when to quit, isn't it? And I think after our marathon recording session, which is enough for a podcast in itself, I'm going to seed that with our producer Martin, I think it's time for us to bring this to an end. Nick, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Thanks to Nick Fry for speaking to us. We'll be back on January the 30th. In the meantime, there's lots of other podcasts from the Motorsport Network. You'll hear me interviewing Lando Norris on the Autosport podcast shortly. If you're into milk float racing, there's the catchily titled Current Affairs. And if you speak Glaswegian and like motorbikes, then the Tank Slappers is for you.